Welcome to Out of Rotation, volleyball talk for players, coaches, and fans. Presented by the American Volleyball Network. Here's your host, Dan Meskin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We're out of season, and this is Out of Rotation. I would call this season two of Out of Rotation. We took a little bit of a break during Division I NCAA women's volleyball season. Planned to try and release some podcasts during season and realized very, very quickly that due to time constraints and editing and the release schedule, I just was not going to be able to keep up with that. So I think this is kind of the schedule we're going to stick with. Is as much as this is the Out of Rotation podcast, it's going to be out of season. So for those of you that are enjoying the holiday, I hope you guys have a great Christmas, great holiday season, safe travels. And if you are traveling and pop on this podcast, you are in for a treat. As we re-release this podcast, I've got a backlog of some pretty cool conversations I had just before our season started. So as I've thought about what order to release these, the first name that kept coming to mind was Charlie Sullivan. And if you're not familiar with Charlie Sullivan, it's probably because you're a women's volleyball fan or player or coach. Charlie comes from the men's side of the game. So he's a Division III head coach at Springfield College. And not only that, he's an 11-time national champion. At one point, he went to the national championship final 10 times in a row. He's hyper successful. So obviously, he's doing something right. But the thing you're going to enjoy about this podcast is that Charlie has what I'd like to think is one of the most unique just journeys to finding coaching. So you'll find out in the first few minutes here, his first volleyball match that he saw was the first volleyball match that he coached. And wrapping your head around that, it's pretty wild. But once you talk to Charlie and you just see the way that he's wired, I think you could pop Charlie into any type of business or coaching or coach any sport and he'd be successful. He's just wired that way. So if you're not a fan of men's volleyball, if you're not a fan of Springfield College, you're going to be after this conversation. Because like I said, Charlie is one of the most interesting people that I've had an opportunity to interview on this podcast. So with that, I want to get you guys to part one of my conversation with Charlie Sullivan from Lucky to Legend.
This is my 25th year as head coach, just finished 25. Yeah. But I've been on campus as an undergrad and grad for 32 years total.
32 years total at Springfield College. But getting into your experience at Springfield there, I want to jump right into it. So I think one of the most unique things about you, aside from all the success and everything that you've done as a coach, is the fact that your route to finding volleyball and finding coaching and all that is really unique. So take me through and walk me through a little bit of how somebody finds themselves, you know, not playing at a huge D1 and doing all these things as a player, but then finds themselves as this fantastic coach all of a sudden. How do you crack into coaching if you're not playing the sport growing up and you're around it all the time?
So jelly side up is a term that's used for people who have great fortune. My dad put it another way. He said, you're the type of person that falls down the stairs and comes up with a haircut and shave. So it's you're saying about someone who gets into a coaching position with limited playing experience. The first volleyball match I ever saw was the first one I coached with no playing experience. So,
hold on, back up. The first volleyball match you saw was the first volleyball match you coached. You need to walk me through that.
So, I'm graduated from Springfield College. I have a tryout in South Africa in January to play soccer for one of the pro teams in South Africa. We had a grad student who's a general manager of the South African professional team at Springfield College. And he said, yeah, come in January. So I was going to go to London and train with a third or fourth division team for the fall. And about the third night of going out, I ran out of all my money. And so I went to a school and said, I need to cut the lawn or do something to make money. And they said, well, our sister school in Rome, Italy, is looking for a AD, phys ed teacher and coach. And I was a phys ed major at Springfield College. And I said, I'm not really interested in the job, but I'll go to Rome to check it out with the interview. So I ended up, I got offered the job and I said I would stay till December, which is insane to think that you're going to start in a school system and only be there half the year as the AD, a teacher and a coach. So we're there and it was the first year the school had gone co-ed. It was an all-girls school. And there was an all-boys school in Rome that closed down the year prior. And they were, you know, they were trying to build a sports program, which hadn't existed at the school, to attract more boys in the international community in Rome, Italy. And so they said, listen, the first sport we have is boys volleyball. It's really important that we have a good season because we need to build a foundation for this athletics part, which you're the AD. So that's your main job here. And it's just really important we have a good year and the boys team does well and it goes really well and we can kind of establish ourselves. And I walked out of the office with this other guy. He said, I'm not doing that. That's crazy. So we flipped the coin. I lost the coin toss and therefore came up with a haircut and shave and started my career as a volleyball coach.
What is the first thing that you do
yeah.
when you say, okay, I've never played in a game, I've never coached in a game, and I need yeah. to go coach a volleyball team?
Yeah.
What in the world is the first thing that you do? You track down a book? Are you, I mean, again, it's before Google, it's before ChatGPT.
Let me give you three things.
Okay.
So first thing I do is contact the volleyball coach at Springfield College, who I didn't know. I never had in a class or anything, and said, I'm stuck, help me. No internet back then, no email. So write a letter and get a package back with drills and books and things like that. Secondly, it was a pretty amazing time to think about, you know, I always say it's really easy to think outside the box when you have no idea what the box is.
So here
I am thinking about service Eve, and here's an example of how it's going to teach service Eve. So I just know about angles. I could see it. It hits your arms and it goes there. It hits your arms. Your arms are facing there. It goes there. So I had the facilities guy cut me up like boards, like 3 feet long, 2 feet wide. And I had the guys hold the boards between their arms and the ball would hit the board to teach them angles and service Eve.
When I first started in Nebraska, yeah. we thought this was like super innovative. We did the exact same thing.
Wow.
We were like, we thought the board only knows angles. And here you are yeah. as a brand new first time head coach. And it's like the most obvious thing. I remember breaking down the skill and coming up with what I thought was like a fantastic way to teach this. Little did I know in Rome, you were like reinventing the wheel out there.
Well, it's just like, that's what I'm saying. It's a really pure thought about the whole game. And you know, I think that's helped me throughout my career because I'm not boxed into a mythical way. You have to do this, you have to do that. I'm always willing to do anything that's going to be good. It's an easy movement for the guys to make that's effective and that, you know, produces a high quality of play. And then thirdly, I would say is that, you know, I was on a really cohesive team in college that performed exceptionally well, well above, you know, the sum of their parts. And I knew about team cohesion, teamwork. And so the first game, my pregame speech, was a speech I stole from the Isaiah Thomas, the basketball player documentary. And he grew up in Detroit, and he had like 8 brothers and sisters. And his mom took 8 pencils and put it in her fist. And she said, you try to break these pencils. And they all tried, and you can't break. It's really hard to break a number of pencils in it that are all clumped together. And she said, but take this pencil, and the pencil breaks instantly. She goes, if you guys leave yourselves, your brothers and sisters alone in this neighborhood, in these streets, in this situation, you're going to break. But if you stick together out there, you can make it through all the challenges that are going to happen in life in Detroit. And that was my pregame speech. So our biggest guy gave him like 18 pencils. He couldn't break them. And then I gave our libero, our weakest guy, the one pencil. He snapped it. And I said, that's all I know about volleyball for you right now, is that you have to stick together out there, play as a team. And these things are really important to be at your best and play to our potential.
I'm ready to run through a wall right now. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So those are the three things I did. And I just started coaching. I never told anyone. I didn't know anything about volleyball. The manager was Stefano. He's like this 4-foot guy, sophomore. And I kept on saying, hey, are the rules the same here as they are in America?
That's a great line.
Like everyone left the bench after game one. And I was like, well, we're going over there? Go, yeah, well, we do the same thing in America. It's crazy. I didn't think you did it here in Italy. So, yeah, I kept on saying stuff like that all the time.
That is awesome. And like I said, I'm ready to run through a brick wall right now. I love that speech. So
yeah.
after people hear this, I hope they think I'm going to use that. And I hope they think that, like, man, this is so creative that you came up with that.
Again, that was before internet and social media. I don't know where I saw it, but...
Well, I want to keep moving here, but just staying on that one more time, because I think it's interesting to find out how people think. And without Google, without email, without all of that, how are you continuing? You know, you had some books, you had, you know, some drills sent to you from, you know, from the coach from Springfield, but how are you continuing to learn and grow? And just, again, I would feel like I'm just like, where do I even go? So a lot of it's got to be self-reflection, but what do you do in that when you don't have just unlimited resources? How are you learning?
So if we met at a barbecue, you might not think this, but I've learned over my career that I'm uber, uber competitive. It's not like so much that it's about winning. It's just that I hate losing.
There's a major difference there. Bad. So explain to me what the difference is to you between like loving to win and hating to lose. Because I'm always intrigued by people because I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer. I think I certainly prefer hating to lose more. But what's the difference for you?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I love to win, and it's a rush. It might be an insecurity thing where losing kind of brings out some inefficiencies that you have, but I hate to lose. And this was it, especially when the odds are stacked against me, when you tell me I can't do something, that's when I'm really in it to win it and avoiding the loss. And this was, I'd competed in sports my whole life. And like I said, I'm pretty mellow off the court, out of the arena, out of the environment. But it was the first year I wasn't playing in a sport all of a sudden. I wasn't preparing myself to be great. I wasn't working out. I wasn't doing mental stuff. And that all that energy went into learning the sport of volleyball. I remember like writing down a 4-2 rotation, a 5-2 5-2 rotation, and figure out rotations and look, service eve and specialization and all this stuff. And I remember being in my room, just like standing up, like pump fist and being like, yes, I got the 5-1. This is unbelievable. So everything went in to being a great volleyball coach. And the odds were stacked against us because this boys school, there's a boys school and two international schools. We were a girls school. And then we turned co-ed. Like I said, the boys school is closed and all the athletic boys went to the other international school because there's no sports program in our school.
Jeez.
So this team was like 2-14 the year before. And all the good players went over there and we got the rest of them. And here, you know, I don't want to lose. So I just knew everything that I was doing was uber competitive, a lot of energy that I have in my body that I wasn't using. And then, you know, like I say, I just don't want to be bad.
Moving on to your Springfield years. So I don't know if you've seen your record. You probably don't know it. So I went and calculated, added last year. You're sitting at 499 and 194. So, I mean, just an unbelievable amount of probably stories within those 600-700 matches, almost 500 wins. Is that something that you're aware of, that you're one away from 500?
My AD mentioned something about that, but I didn't really want to listen to him. So that's pretty irrelevant. But that's when we played as a Division I school as well. It's not only Division III.
So when you hear that 499 and 194, you mentioned for a while you were Division I, then you guys have now gone Division III. But what sticks out to you when you hear, because not very often do we hear our career record. We might hear our season record and then we look at that or whatever. But you hear all of that. I mean, 499 and 194, I mean, that's more matches than a lot of coaches coach their entire career. What sticks out to you when you hear that? Just what's your initial reaction?
Not much, because I really don't live in the past much at all. I mean, what am I doing right now to make our team better? Did I recruit enough today? Did I work out? Did I work on our team enough today? I mean, I really don't try to be in the past too often, unless I'm learning something from it.
Yeah.
There's some great memories there. There's some phenomenal people that went through our program and some phenomenal efforts and team play. But you know, I want to see. I'm really worried about our team. I want to get better next year. So
I like it. I think that's a pretty common coach mentality there. I'm always just curious when we hear like our entire record. It's like, because yeah, a lot of people have that reaction of like, I don't know. That's just what happened. Like, people have to write that down. People have to write stories, right?
Yeah.
The couple of things I want to do in your career at Springfield here. The first is, when I went through year by year, 2003 to 2004, you've had fantastic years. You've had a lot of 30 plus wins. Again, we're close to 500 in career wins. 2003, 2004, you mentioned you were back in Division I and you guys were kind of maybe going to transition to D3 at some point there. But those were the toughest years. You were hovering around like 500 some of those years. You were in the teens for wins, which some people getting the teens and wins on a 30 game season is fine. But again, those, if you just look at the entire thing, there's not a lot of years that stick out. And those two really looked like, okay, they were a challenge. And I'm just always so curious, like, some coaches get stuck in that rut and it's okay, we're 500, then we're, you know, then we're below 500, then we're barely above it. And coaches just level off. And here all of a sudden we fast forward to what you've done in the last 5 years, and I'll get to your record there, but your program's been unbelievable. I'm just so curious how you got out. I mean, those 2 years must have been really challenging. And like you said, you're always trying to learn. You're always trying to grow. But what did you learn during those 2 years that you were able to pivot so much with the program, and now you guys are just crushing it?
You know, I think those years were just a result of time put in to recruiting. I think I think one of the, if there's an accolade that's, I don't know, pretty different for our program is that we won a national championship and I had three kids under 5 years old. And that work-life balance is difficult. I think I was getting crushed a little bit by starting a new lifestyle. And we had some, our opponents definitely had some really good teams at that time. And, you know, as in terms of how you get back going, we just decided that we're going to work harder and you know, especially recruit a little differently and pivot from what we're doing to do something more effectively. And I think that's something that's been good for our program through my career is that we just never want to settle. Like, I just don't want to be settling for average or take one situation lightly. Therefore, we wouldn't perform to our potential in that situation. Like I was just playing cards with some friends last night and they get mad at me because I always bid in high, low jack or pitch. I always bid. And I was like, I don't want to give control to anyone else, even if I can only get two tricks, but I need three. I think I'd rather battle that way rather than try to defend someone else being in control and settle for a pass.
The best defense is a great offense. I love that. Let me stay in that moment for a little, because we're 20 years ago right now. So I can tell you're like, hey, I don't live in the past. This is 20 years ago. Like, I get it. But let's say that somebody's listening and they're in that right now. They've had 2 years where they've really struggled. Put yourself in that office. You're the head coach. You're meeting with your staff there. What does that feel like in that moment of like, hey, things haven't been good for the last couple of years. We get that. You know, here's my assessment on that. But here's what we're doing moving forward. Like, how in those moments do you continue to stay cohesive as a staff? And again, you talked about some new, you know, different players or things like that. Like, how do you stay cohesive as a staff and as a program moving forward and keep everybody on the same page?
Well, to stay cohesive as a staff, I mean, just it's constantly a relationship where we're communicating really well with each other. The expectations are clear that we can handle situations together really well. But, you know, we do something after our season, which is called the good, the bad, the ugly. And like, it usually pertains to our last match. Like that was our last evaluation. So here's things that we did that were good. Here's things that are bad and here's things that are ugly. And so we kind of make a plan right away of things that we definitely need to get better on and things that we need to modify to do a little better and keep doing the things we're doing well. So, I just, like I said, you just don't want to be, after 2 years being like, oh, well, I don't enjoy talking to coaches that are like, well, you know, when you don't pass the ball and you have 28 service errors, it's hard to win. Like I look at that as kind of like cop out or settle, you know, like, no, we need to, how do you teach serving? I need to get better at teaching serving. And, you know, that serve receive that we're having trouble with, like, how do we make that better? So what am I going to do and go out and prepare myself to get to another level to coach effectively so my players can play to their potential?
Well, I don't know if it's because you're talking to a women's coach right now that you brought up the serving right away. And I want to continue on your journey at Springfield, but I have to pivot right now when you brought up the serving errors, because I'm sure every women's coach you talk to is like, why the heck do you guys miss so many serves? And I am in the same boat. I think I love blocking. It's my favorite skill in all of volleyball. And I feel like if you teach it well, a one-on-one blocker can be fantastic. Like one-on-one, you still should be able to touch the ball. I don't care what level you're at. I don't care how good they are. That's I don't care what they touch. So why in the heck in the men's game do they miss so many serves and say, oh, the offense is so good. If we don't serve tough, we can't defend them. Explain to me the service errors or at least your opinion on the service errors.
Yeah. So my question back to you for that question is what's a lot of service errors? What does that mean?
To me, it's in a 25-point game, I think it's more than four in a set is a lot. I mean, we're starting to get into maybe 20% of the points that they need to score, they're getting without any effort. So to me, four to five at any level, you're going about 20% of the points that are needed to score to beat you that you are giving to them.
And we're a pretty aggressive serving team overall. I mean, if we can have six guys jumping with their serve 100% aggressive, we'll go for that.
So you'll be all right with the five, like what? So what's the number? Let me shoot that back to you. What's the number that, you know, I heard Hugh McCutchen say this once and it stuck with me. This was after winning a gold with the men and he was doing a coach's clinic and he said something that really stuck with me and I still battle with it. And he said, find the number of service errors that you should be at and get there, whether you're above it or below it, because if you're below it, you're not serving tough enough. And if you're above it, you're being much too aggressive. And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at how aggressive we are serving, but I also thought it maybe simplified it a little too much. So for you guys, you said you're a super aggressive serving team. Yeah. Do you define that for your team similar to that? Or how are you talking to your guys about serving?
Yeah. So we want to be overall 20% errors. So no matter if it's 6 or 5 or 4, we're looking at more of a percentage. And
there's
so,
a reason we yeah. connected on this podcast, because I just threw that number out and said about 20%. And you said that. So that's the cutoff. You get to 22, 23, 20, 25. That's too much. Like 25%.
Yeah.
That's too much service areas.
And we can live around there, but we're living dangerously.
Okay.
We need to be attacking really at an efficient level, and we can't have a net violation or a ball handling error or anything like that, or get aced. So overall, I know if we have less than 8 errors total, then we're doing pretty well in that game. Like, we're winning 90% of the time.
So if you were to take, and again, we're going over 20 plus years, but if you were to take yourself back to a match where you were very evenly matched, I don't want to go against a low level team that it can't pass, but you're very, very evenly matched, and you thought you served like there's no perfect game, but that was the perfect game of serving. How many service errors were you guys at? How did that roll? What was the ace to error ratio?
I don't even know the errors per game. I know we were under 20% and we probably got 3 or 4 aces. Beautiful. And we don't lose those games.
I love that.
Yeah. And I thought you were going to ask me when you started the question, again, that we were pretty evenly matched and we had too many service errors.
Well, let me shoot it back to you because I want to hear where that goes. So let me ask you that. A match where you're really evenly matched and you felt like you had too much service errors, is that one where you said, hey, if we would have just, you know, popped some in, we might have had a chance to turn a point? Take me through a match like that.
So we lost the national championship. We probably had like 420 hitting percentage, and we lost the championship, and we had 4 games and a couple of deuce games we lost, and we had 28 service errors. So we went for 7 a game. But my problem is that I'm very positive. And so I was saying in my head the whole time, we've missed so many. We're not going to miss anymore. I mean, this is a cycle. It's all cyclical, right? It's going to come back, and we're going to get our 4 aces after 18. It's going to be phenomenal. So looking back, regretfully, the Monday morning quarterback, I said to myself, I probably should have had some guy just pop a float in or something so we can do some block D.
But you say that in hindsight. If you're in that situation again, I find it hard to believe with who you are and what I've heard from you that you would say, hey, let's scale it back. Because I do agree with you. Like take basketball, for example, great three-point shooter misses 3 and assumes, hey, I'm going to make the next 3. You know, you miss 3 to make 3.
Yeah.
I get that mentality with serving too. So
to your point, I probably wouldn't, to this day, I would do the same thing in that situation. And we've developed our serving mentality a little different since then. You know, we believe, like, true to Andrea Becker's philosophy with the national team, when I spent time with the national team before the 2016 Olympics, that if you're doing the same thing every time, that your probability of being successful increases. Where if you're saying after a timeout, hit an 80% shot, if you're saying, don't rip it after you score 2. So we just want to consistently do the same thing every time. We think that builds the probability of being more successful. So we play a game. I give a guy I give him 20 flashcards, and on the back it has an X or an O. And there's 4 that have an O, and there's 16 that have an X. So that's 80% of X's. And I say, I'm going to turn the card over. Before I turn it over, you guess what it is, an X or an O. I do it with a rookie every year, right? And if he just says X every time, and I say, we don't want you to get 100%. We just need you to get 80%. So you figure it out. It starts going. The guys start helping him. If he says X every time, he'll get 4 wrong, and he'll get exactly what we need. So we relate the same thing to serving. So we say, if you do the same thing every time, you're going to get your efficiency that we need. We truly believe that. And then – In that regard, we always want to have a smart serve where we had good toss, confident, and we ripped. So the guy has a big error. So we have to live with some errors for sure. We were up 11-8 in our national championship game this year in our quarterfinal. We missed a serve. Probably looking back, if he would have made that, we've had a better chance. If he scored on that, I think we have a better chance to win that game 5. So when those errors happen, you have to accept them. And I accept that match we lost in that when we hit 420 something and we had 20 service errors. Because we've won so many more matches with our serve. And we just ask the guy when he comes off. We define if you're confident, you have a good toss, and you rip, we call that a smart serve. So if he has an error, and I say, was that a smart serve? He says, yes. I said, that's awesome. You're the greatest. I love you. Great job.
If he says,
no, it wasn't a smart serve, I was like, well, you got some controllables you have to take care of back there because we need smart serves from you.
That's great.
But we do believe if they're doing the same thing every time, even if it's aggressive, that you can go and you can be successful. And if there's anything to do that's less aggressive, where you're increasing your probabilities to score because you're avoiding errors, then that's a totally different serve. Like, we had one guy this year that he never really served 3 in a row. So if he scored 2, we had him jump float.
Really? So that's a guy who would lose the X's and O game. He would mix he it would up. Lose, he would X, yeah. O, X, it's
like... He was a young guy. He needs a little more time to develop our serve. And we have a particular serve we're doing too. So, but yeah, we'd have him jump float into a spot. And because we know, of course, like, you know, as well, like team side out percentages goes down incrementally every time you serve another ball into him. So
yeah,
we call it trifecta. If we get a side out and two serves, we're going to celebrate you. And we call when you have 3-4 serves in a row, we call that going streaking. I thought Will Ferrell, I'm getting so old. Will Ferrell is too old for these guys. I'm like, have you ever seen old school when Will Ferrell goes streaking? That's what we want from you. And they looked at me like I had 8 heads. I was like, God,
you got me in stitches. I love this, man. This is like,
if I can't reference Will Ferrell, then I have nowhere else to go. I don't even know what you guys are talking about anymore.
That's when you start feeling old. Yeah. Wow. That is fantastic stuff on serving. Yeah. I love all that we covered there. And I tell you, it just, the list adds up of phrases I'm going to steal from you. I love the going streaking too, because I mean, that's the same thing in every level. It's like, man, you said 4 or 5. I mean, that's a set right there. You go a 4 or 5 point run. It is so hard to recover from that. Now, back in the day when we used to go to 30, anything was in play, but 25 is a sprint, and 4 or 5 point service run, that'll usually do it for you. All right. So I want to go to some more current Springfield College numbers here, and your record since 2012 has been nothing short of unbelievable. So if I go through some of the years here, it's worth kind of pointing these out. 2012, we go 33-1, national championship. 2013, 32-1, more of the same, national championship. 2014, 27-3, national championship. Then you, I mean, that must have been a failure of a year, but you go 2 years in a row in the national final. Then you win 2 more national championships in 17 and 18. Then we hit COVID. National championship final in 2020. We go over those years, 2012 to 2022, we go 285 and 15, a 95% win percentage. And what most people will look at, your April record, your postseason record, 64 and 7, 90% winning percentage. Pretty unbelievable to hear all that back to back to back. There's so much to unpack there. Before I get into what's been going so right in those years, you mentioned earlier that you love when people underestimate you. And anybody who knows anything about your program is no longer underestimating you. So how do you continue to find the motivation that you used to have when you were a brand new coach back in Italy and had no experience and everyone was underestimating you? I don't think that's happening anymore.
Well, we had some pretty significant records take place during that run. We were in the national championship final 10 years in a row. We had a season 1 year. We had a veteran group coming back, and I said to our setter, who now sets for the national team in Puerto Rico, I said, we're going to hit over 400 next year. Like, it's never been done in men's volleyball, and we're going to do it. And he said, let's do it. And we hit 421 that year.
Wow.
And that was the record. And we set a record for consecutive sets won in the season. I think we're at 47 or 48.
47 consecutive sets won. How many matches did that span over? I can't even do the math.
Yeah, so 11, 14 or something like that.
It's like
so
months of not losing a set.
Yeah. And the set we lost was, I did a presentation in Boston. I met the team there, and we didn't go through our regular kind of mental preparation on the bus ride. And we lost set one, and then 1-4. But it could have been more. But I think that was a really cool. I remember one of those games, we were in a deuce game, and we had scouted that when the middle takes it with his hands, like in area two, he gets set. When the middle takes it with his hands in transition or something, short ball, in area four, he doesn't get set. It goes go or red. And he took a ball in area four and in area two, and our area four and area three blocker committed and got that was the point that won the 32-30 game, which continued the streak. So I thought to myself, I'm glad we did a lot of scouting for that game, because we would have been in trouble. I mean, then when we won 3, which was cool, but so like those were significant years, and we're trying to get back there right now. We're not really there, and our roster is a little younger right now, and we're working hard to get to a level where we can do those kind of things again.
So take me back to those years. You had 10 national finals in a row. Again, I want to get back to the motivation while that's going on, because again, you talked about somebody who loves to be underestimated and you love to prove people wrong. Yeah. You go to 10 national championship matches in a row. No one's underestimating you. So how that's, I mean, that's a transition for people. It's like the journey to get there is sometimes, I think, easier than staying there. It's like getting good is sometimes harder than staying good. So to get to 10 in a row, I'm just curious the transition of the motivation of what we're doing day in and day out. I mean, obviously we want to try to keep things the same, but the expectations rise and we can't not we can't not acknowledge the fact that things are a little different when we're trying to repeat as champions, or we're trying to, you know, come back from a national final the year before. I only bring that up because we've been to two Final Fours the last 2 years, and we've had to evolve some expectations. You know, 7 years ago when I got to Louisville, yeah, we were picked to finish eighth in the conference. I mean, we were getting underestimated. It was great. We loved it.
Yeah.
And now things have completely changed. I'm just curious, with your program, 10 national finals in a row, how does the motivation change when people are no longer underestimating you?
Well, we were underestimated when we were playing in a Division I conference as a Division III school. So, you know, to beat a Division I school in the IVA quarterfinal and semifinal, it's pretty cool. And we avoid doing the same thing now. We're definitely not underestimated. Everyone plays their best game versus us, and we don't take any match, any set, any rally lightly. We had a young team this year, 6 first-year guys, and they took a match lightly, and we got stung. So I always ask the guys, like, what's worse, getting stung by 10 bees or 100 bees? And they're like, well, 100. I was like, well, let me tell you that both suck. So if you go into the beehive with all the gear on, you know, the face, the gloves, the boots, you're prepared. You're good. You don't get stung by any bees. So let's go into the match, even though you guys think you're going to roll them and they don't, you don't think they're not going to play. They're going to play a Super Bowl type match, and we're going to have to play our A game to be our potential. So what you said, journey. And we always say that the guy who likes the journey goes farther than the guy that yearns for the destination.
I love that.
So we're all about the process. And
that almost goes back to what you talked about earlier of hating to lose. It's like, if you love to win, you're thinking about the destination. You're thinking about how great it's going to be when you're at the destination. If you hate to lose, you're taking care of that entire process to get there. You're loving the process of prep. And that actually brings me into the process of prep. Now, you talked about one of those matches within that 10 years that you had a speaking engagement and you missed the mental prep on the bus. And it's funny, like, that's what, you know, in hindsight, probably an insignificant match or whatever within those years.
Yeah.
And you remember it like it's yesterday because you didn't do that mental prep on the bus. What sparked me on that is I love the mental prep that goes into games. Can you bring me a little bit onto the bus of what's going on there? Is that something you still do to this day? What does the mental prep feel like on the bus? Because the other thing I love about that too is, you know, if I'm coaching a club team, I'm at a convention center. I've got to get creative. Yeah. Like you're talking about, maybe you don't have a great locker room, but you're just finding a way to do it on the bus. That mental prep obviously is really important. If you would, can you take me through what we're trying to accomplish there?
It wasn't much at the time. It was more just reviewing the scout report. And we always have like a message before we get off the bus of what the theme was we're latching on to that day. And then we'll have a message in the locker room before we get out to our warm up. So, whatever the message was that day, I didn't have a chance to share it with the guys to be good. So I met him in the locker room. So we only had like one part of our preparation instead of the full compliment.
So you're speaking to an assistant coach here. Did your assistant coach botch the mental prep? You're like, you got this one. They did it. You lost. And you're like, never again.
Probably as a negligent head coach, I didn't give the responsibility clearly enough to the assistant coach and didn't get it done. So it's probably my fault.
That's great. You know, just wrapping up on the Springfield years, there's been so many national championships. There've been so many appearances in the final. There's been so many 30 plus, you know, win seasons. There's been amazing things. What sticks out to you when you think of, you know, your tenure so far at Springfield College?
That, you know, I demand a lot from the players in the program. We want to be excellent and professional in everything we're doing. And in that process, we get a lot out of our guys. And I think they learn a lot from that process. They grow as people, not only volleyball players. We say on senior night, we're not celebrating our senior volleyball players. We're celebrating our senior volleyball people. And so I think by demanding so much from them and always being in a level where we can get better, I think that's a good life lesson for them to learn. So, you know, we don't recruit kids for 4 years. We recruit kids for 40 years. So to see that take place like 20 years later, like in your situation with 3 kids and a family and, you know, good relationships and good at community and good at skills and building culture, that's the reward.
That's awesome. Last thing on Springfield, most satisfying match or season or moment, what sticks out? Something pops in your head right away of just, man, that felt really good.
Yeah. We had a year. So the IVA was set up a few years. They had this formation where they had 2 divisions, and it was the top division and the lower division. And if you lost the top division, you were sent down. If you won the bottom division, you were relegated up, kind of like the English soccer system. And we had won the bottom division with a really heavily senior team. and we moved up, but now we're all freshmen and sophomores. And so we were really glued into the process that year. And I think it's one of the years we had like 3 wins in the regular season. But that the national championship was the Moulton National Championship at the time. So the qualifications weren't so cut and dry like they are now. And we actually qualified for the East Coast Division III National Championship match. And if you won the East Coast Division III semifinal and final, you went on to the Moulton National Championship quarterfinal or semifinal. So you went to the Final Four. And we had been drilling all year about just getting better and not focusing on losses. And we were playing better and we were losing a lot of close games at the end of the year to NJIT, to Princeton, to Penn State. And we get into the postseason and we are playing without a couple guys because the first year that education had a teacher's test. So our starters aren't there and we're totally vulnerable right now. We have nobody and we're just, you know, we're all about the process. And we played great and we won the East Coast championship to go to the Final Four. And so being such a special team that was really good at not worrying about winning and losing, but worrying about all the other things, it portrayed itself. We were down 11-3 in the national championship semifinal. I'm going to speak with names here because we speak about it openly. Sam Schweischke, the coach of Princeton, was on the Vassar team that we're playing. He's going to argue it was 11-4, but 11-3 is a much better story because it's even more phenomenal. So we were down 11-3, and I called the second timeout. Hashtag bag time to call a timeout. I don't know what I was waiting for. But I remember looking at our group in the timeout, and I remember touching Mark Schlaubach's face like he was my son and saying, this is out of the realm of possibilities for a lot of teams, but not for this team, not what we've been through this year. And we battled back, and then we got to 16-all, and our middle had a true hitting error. It was like, oh, how did that happen? And we ended up winning like 2018 and game 5 to go to the national championship final. And that was our first national championship final. So whatever year that was. And wow. Your notes, that's the year that happened. So, you know, there's been a lot of it, to answer your question, a lot of extraordinary matches and a lot of great efforts and a lot of great focus. Like when your team goes out there in a national championship and they're just dead on with their focus and their execution and working with each other, it's a phenomenal feeling. But that match always comes, like when you ask that question, the match. I mean, that one match has a pretty phenomenal result. I mean, there's a 5% chance, 3% chance you win that game, 5. And in that scenario where we're playing national championship semifinal with, you know, the uber amount of pressure that's on you.
It's unbelievable. So
it's really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Out of Rotation with your host, Dan Meske, presented by the American Volleyball Network. Until next time, come on. Don't give them any free points. Always stay in rotation.